Hey, this is Jessie Wilkerson, and I'm at the home of June Rostan, and this is July 6, 2009. Okay. I want to start, June, by asking you, what were your very first experiences as an activist? I guess when did you have your start in this long career?
Oh, okay. I guess I'd say college or high school.
What did you do?
Oh, in high school? Oh, it was weird stuff. It was like, nah, I guess that wasn't really activism. I organized us to get gold lame caps and gowns. I don't think that really counts as activist, but people in the class did not want them. I think we ended up with black or something. So I guess my first experiences as an activist were in college, and that it involved working to end the war in Vietnam and also working for students' rights and women's rights, because the women students at Maryville College at that time were treated differently from the men. We were locked in the dorms at night, so some of us got involved in pushing for changes in regulations and rules for women students.
Mm-hmm. So did you start organizations to do that?
We used the existing women's, the women's student government was already kind of organized in the dorms. Mm-hmm. They had organizations, and so we kind of used those, and we just put up signs and stuff in the dormitories saying that we, you know, wanted changes and stuff. And mm-hmm. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but and had meetings with the dean of women, and we just kept pushing. Until we got the rules changed and we got keys for seniors, for juniors and seniors to the dorms so that we could stay out past hours. And then we also were required to wear dresses to class and to the dining room. And on that, some of us just started wearing pants mm-hmm. in the dining room, and it just caught on and they couldn't stop it then. Mm-hmm. There was nothing they could do.
Did you see that as part of women's rights or the women's rights movement? Or what was it that made you all think that you should, start pushing for changes?
Well, I didn't really know that there was a national women's movement, I don't think, at that time. But I knew that it wasn't fair for women students to be treated differently. I hadn't been treated differently in my own home. Well, a little bit maybe, but I mean, I guess my brother got a little bit more leeway, but there weren't significant differences in how we were treated as children and teenagers in my home. So to me, it seemed very unfair that women students were locked in the dormitories and the men could roam the campus and the town all night long. Mm-hmm. And also that there was a dress code that meant that women had to wear skirts to classes and to chapel and to in the dining hall. We brought the college into the modern age. We did them a favor, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was looking back at our past interview, and you had mentioned briefly going to Italy when you were in college.
It was after college. In fact, I had gotten a master's degree at Appalachian State in special education, deaf education, and so I then went to Italy for 2 years as a frontier intern. Mm-hmm. And so I got involved in the women's movement in Italy, and I was in a consciousness raising group with about four or five other women. And also, did a study group session on women's issues with women alumni of the night school. And then I also worked for this group of people who were Waldensians and Methodists and dissenting Roman Catholics, ran a night school for young workers to get their middle school diploma. So I taught English in the night school, and I helped design some practical-based curriculum for them to use that related to the workers' experience. And then I also was part of a group in Milan that, a women's group that helped start a women's clinic in a working-class neighborhood where women could get birth control. Mm-hmm. And the debates were starting then about, you know, about abortion, too. Because at that time in Italy, there was no divorce. I think the referendum on divorce was held when I was there, or shortly, maybe it was later, because I would go back to Italy about every 5 years and visit for several weeks. So I can't remember exactly what year the referendum on divorce was. It may have been when I was there from 72 to 74.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think getting more involved politically in the women's movement in Italy was different from the sort of movement people got involved in the States? I mean, it sounds like class maybe was more part of your, class consciousness was more part of it, or?
Well, the women's movement in Italy, many of the women who were involved in it, the women in my, in the consciousness raising group that I were in, most of them came from middle class families. They were going to university, or they worked in white collar jobs, teachers, office workers. And the women's, and then the women who were students in the school were, came from working class families, and themselves were factory workers. In Italy, you know, the workers' movement, the union movement, and the left was really grounded in a class struggle. Mm-hmm. And so the development of the feminist movement in Italy was for the most part made of women who came out of those political, either left political groups, or had been in trade unions. Many of them had been in, you know, the teachers' union or other kinds of unions where they worked. And so, yeah, I think because of that, it was different. Had I been here in the United States, I think my experience would have been interesting to see how it would have been different, because I don't know if I would have been in a consciousness-raising group. Maybe, I don't know. And Milan was a pretty big city. I lived outside of Milan in a city called Cinisello, which had about 90,000 inhabitants. So I think that the women's movement in this country probably took very different form and fashion, mm-hmm. in rural areas and in cities. Mm-hmm. And because I was in and were near a big city in Italy, that it made it possible for me to be in a consciousness-raising group. And but then also it was a different, it was because the women's movement was inserted or in part or grew out of a left movement that was very much based in trade unionism and an analysis of class, mm-hmm. made it a bit different too.
Let's see. What life experiences prepared you for your work as an activist and community organizer? And I ask that because some people have family experiences, or, you know, saw their parents doing certain things that helped prepare them.
Well, my mother always worked outside the home. She always had a paying job, except for, I think, maybe a year she took off once or twice when we were born. So that really influenced me, because in the 50s, not everybody, you know, his mother worked, had a paying job. And so the family, the household work was divided. My father kept us during the daytime because he worked the night shift and the bakery. And mother worked in the office at this big bakery. So he kept us, and he would make supper, and he also helped with the housework. And so that also, that gave me a sense of that men could do those kinds of jobs and share more equitably in the household, in running the household, taking care of children and running the household.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. You know, it seems strange, but I would say Girl Scouts, too, was a shaping factor. Was in terms of learning leadership qualities and how to get along in a group and how to really do group work, that Girl Scouts was. And we had a couple of Girl Scout leaders that were really phenomenal. One of the women was, she didn't have any children of her own, and she had been raised on a farm, and she could do everything. And so we did a lot of outdoor stuff, too, like camping, and we did 50 miles on the Appalachian Trail when we were in the eighth grade. So we did a lot of things that really helped form our identity as girls who could do lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a factor. And I guess those are basically the main things.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned being in Italy being in a city, and that giving you opportunities to get involved with the consciousness raising group. But I also wonder how growing up in the South shaped your understanding of women's liberation or the women's movement.
Oh. You know, I let me backtrack too, and also mm-hmm. say that I think my two grandmothers were a real factor too, because both of them, my father's mother ended up raising her kids because her husband went into a mental institution when they were in Chicago. And she had nine children, and she ended up, a couple of them were already married, but she ended up raising these kids and moving south from Chicago to North Carolina so the older kids could go to work in the textile mills. So she was a very strong person. And then also my mother's mother survived four husbands. Mm. She was married four times and outlived four husbands.
Mm.
And so that was also a factor too. And yet she made sure, you know, that her children were taken care of and stuff. And but growing up in the South, I would think there tends to make you a little bit schizophrenic, may be too strong a word, but there's this supposedly ideal image of the Southern Belle. Of course, that's about women of a certain class, and we weren't in that class because my mother's family were poor dirt farmers, and they had it really tough, and my father's family had it tough too. And so there are a lot of contradictions, I think, about growing up female in the South, where there's this idealized vision of what, you know, the Southern woman is supposed to be, and, you know, you're supposed to, if you've got the money, you're supposed to make your debut, mm-hmm. you know, to society, to be a debutante, and you know, all those other things. And you're supposed to be a cheerleader or a majorette, and yet the reality is that women in the South have it tough. I think even women who were in the upper class, I think had a hard time. Of course, they might have had women servants who waited on them, but in terms of how they were treated and whether their opinion was respected and stuff, there were some. I think often that their opinion wasn't. So I'd say, and I don't know if it's any different in the North. It might be. But in the South, I think there are these contradictions about what women are supposed to do. And then there's what you see, what really happens in terms of what women's lives are like and how women who are left widows and other things have to survive, have to end up doing things. And then I think women... women in Appalachia ended up taking on things sometimes and being the leaders and sticking their necks out during some of the things that happened, even though they were supposed to be chained to the stove and barefoot and pregnant all the time. But, there ended up being women like Florence Reese and the women in the Brookside Women's Group, Women's Auxiliary at Brookside during the strike there, and the men were prohibited from being on the picket line, so the women went out on the picket line. And I can always remember Florence going to some of the men who were sitting down on the railroads during the Brookside strike and really just kind of shaming them and saying, "Aren't you ashamed that your women are up there on the picket line trying to stop the cars from going into the mine and you're down here whittling on the railroad tracks?" So a lot of contradictions between how women were supposed to be treated or idolized or put up on a pedestal, but then how they were actually treated in life, how they had to do a lot of things that were very hard, how they had to be the economic support for their families lots of times, and then how they had to stick their necks out and be the leaders sometimes in some of the fights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the contradictions are even in your own family with your mother and both your grandmothers. They worked and did things on their own.
Right.
That's an interesting
idea. And neither of my grandmothers, I don't think, ever, although my mother's mother may have had a job when she was very young. She may have worked in a textile mill, because I can remember her talking about buying a pair of white kid gloves or something with her wages that she got. But my other grandmother never had a paying job, but she worked so hard. She really did, raising all those kids.
Right.
And she sewed and knit and kept house for one of my aunts for years and years.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. How did you come to be involved in the Coal Employment Project?
Well, I was hired part-time when I was at Highlander to work on... I was hired part-time to work on something, and I can't remember if it was the pregnancy study or I was hired to do something, and then it just evolved into...
From what I saw in the records, it looked like it was the pregnancy study.
I was hired part-time to do that.
Yeah.
I'd been doing something with them, I think. And I was still technically a full-time staff person at Highlander's Coal Employment Project, reimbursed Highlander for my time. Mm-hmm. So I was like the health and safety coordinator for the Coal Employment Project, and I spent probably about half my time at CEP. Mm-hmm. And I started working on some things around health and safety. That was it. And then became the principal investigator for the pregnancy study that they did. And then in 82, right after Highlander's 50th anniversary, Coal Employment Project had decided to really take the parental leave issue on full steam. And so I became the coordinator of that, and I knew that I couldn't do that still being at Highlander, so I left Highlander to go full-time to to the Coal Employment Project. I think that was like in late 1982 or early 83. Yeah, so I did both the pregnancy study and coordinated a campaign to get parental leave in the mine workers contract and as federal legislation. But the women were mostly focusing on the mine workers contract to start with.
So to get the timeline straight here, you were at Highlander, you were staff at Highlander, you were health and safety?
I was a labor education coordinator at Highlander. I started out just teaching GED classes for them with a contract with Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. And then after Bingham Graves left to go to work for the union full-time, I became the labor education coordinator for Highlander. And I did that for 5 years.
How would you describe the CEP's goals in relation to the broader women's movement?
Well, it was an advocacy group for women coal miners, for and of women coal miners. In relationship to the broader women's movement, nationally, I'd say it was a clear, it was a clearly working class group, women in the organization, for the most part, were women who had been coal miners, were or had been coal miners, worked in coal mines. The staff, not all of them had, some of them had or, and some of them weren't, didn't. A couple of them were attorneys. And a couple of them were, you know, just generalists like myself. In terms of the women's movement in Appalachia, I think it's the determination or designation of identity as workers in a particular industry that differentiated that group from other women's groups. Other women's groups, I guess, were based in the community or were groups of women who were fighting for particular women's issues like reproductive rights or freedom from sexual assault and domestic violence, or more broad women's organizations, like there were local chapters of the National Organization of Women during that time. And then there were a few groups that were regionally identified, like the Coalition of Appalachian Women, things like that. So it was that it was that focus on working as a coal miner, a female coal miner that set it apart.
Was there tension there? Were women, especially coal mining women, did they see themselves as part of a women's movement or? Did it seem like something separate? Like, did they embrace that sort of title of feminism or women's liberation, or did it turn out to be something a little different?
I think it was a little bit different. I mean, the answer to that is yes and no. I think they clearly identified with women's rights, the struggle to be treated fairly in the workplace and to not be discriminated against. In the workplace. In some respects, they did not identify with or the issues, like the abortion issue was never raised at I can't remember there ever being any kind of resolutions or anything around abortion. We didn't spend that much time talking about it, but I think there was just kind of a silent assumption that that could be a divisive issue. And so it wasn't brought up. So I think they saw themselves as allied with other tradeswomen's groups. At that time, there were some national groups like Hard-Hatted Women, mm-hmm. women who were in the building trades and other predominantly male industries. And then also there was a group called Women in Fire Suppression or Women Firefighters. So they really closely identified with working class women's organizations, Coalition of Labor Union Women. They were the women miners joined that if there was a CLU chapter in their area. They identified with women in unions, and particularly the industrial unions, mm-hmm. But all unions really. So yeah, there was a class consciousness, I think, on their part. But we did end up working in coalitions with groups like, is it called the National Women's Legal Center? It's a group in Washington that worked on legal issues for women, mostly employment issues. But so they aligned themselves, and often they would align themselves with NOW on a lot of mm-hmm. a lot of things too. You know, generally I think women involved with the Coal Employment Project were in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. I forget what years that period were. Mm-hmm. But, so I think they did consider themselves a part of the women's movement, but their enthusiasm and their energy was really relegated to working class women's organizations and this particular mm-hmm. organization.
Mm-hmm. So how did the mine workers, the United Mine Workers, treat CEP, or what was the relationship like with them?
For the most part, it was a pretty good relationship. I don't know. Since I came there in 82, I guess I started working with them, though, in the late 70s. I went to Highlander in late 77, so it would have been maybe 78 or 79 that I started, or 80, that I started doing some work with Coal Employment Project, and the group had gotten formed in 73. So by that time, the relationship with the union was pretty good. There were occasions when it got kind of rocky, but a lot of the women were UMWA members themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they would get their union locals sometimes to sponsor them, to send them to the women coal miners conferences. And then toward the middle and end of the organization's history, men started coming to the conference too, because they were interested in the issues, and sometimes their local unions would send them. So they got relatively good support from the mine workers. It was very tough for the women, though, to run for office mm-hmm. sometimes at a local level. They had a heck of a fight. And one of the women, Joy Hewitt, ran in one district office in the district in Utah, District 22. But I think she only served one or two terms and then got defeated by another woman. And so some of the women who served in offices early on at the district, there weren't many of them who served, got elected to district offices, but the UMW was organized by districts. Mm-hmm. And they were regionally, geographically based. So women would run for local office and could be successful at that. And I guess there were some other women who eventually became district officers, I think. And there was a woman, Linda Racevich, who worked as a health and safety rep for the International. But the first times they ran for district office or local office, they usually had a pretty tough time. In 83, when we were working on the parental leave campaign, we encouraged women to run as delegates from their locals for the Constitutional Convention of the Mine Workers, because that's where they decided what things they were going to bargain for in their contract. Mm-hmm. They're required by their constitution to hold these constitutional conventions every so often. And there were 10 women who got elected. And I went to that convention. It was in Pittsburgh in December. And, there were a couple thousand men there, and there were 10. I don't know what the official number of delegates there were there. Mm-hmm. But out of all of those, there were 10 women. And it was just, it's such a stark minority. Mm-hmm. And now, when the men in their district or their locals supported them, they really, really supported them. And a lot of the women came from coal mining families, so their fathers and brothers were coal miners. Mm-hmm. And so that sometimes helped them. But they still had a tough row. They had to win the men over sometimes. And sometimes, I think in some instances, they faced some pretty tough opposition.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the CUP decided to focus on pregnancy and the parental leave campaign?
Because the women had raised it as an issue. They had been talking for several years and had passed resolutions at their conference every year about needing time off when they were pregnant. And so it started out as a resolution on maternity leave. Mm-hmm. And then they broadened it to make it parental leave, because they realized that they were such a minority in the union that they'd never get that just for themselves. And then they also said, well, you know, there are men who need off when their wives have babies. Some of the women, some of their wives don't drive, or if there's an illness in the family, of a child or somebody else in the family, there's a serious illness, they often have to drive several hours to a regional medical facility, like in Charleston or Morgantown, West Virginia, or in Pittsburgh. And some of these, or, you know, in, I don't know, in Richmond or Charlottesville or somewhere, if you're in Southwest Virginia. So they had, and so the men, they said, really needed the time off too. Mm-hmm. So that's why they pushed for the parental leave, is they really saw a need as that the women needed more time off than the standard 6 weeks for maternity leave, and that they also saw it and identified it as a need that their union brothers had, and they also knew that it would be easier to get it passed if it was a demand that they made on behalf of themselves and their union brothers. The pregnancy study, there were questions in people's minds about whether women continuing to work in the coal mines during their pregnancies could lead to possible birth defects or problems with the pregnancy. And so that's why they wanted to do the pregnancy study, was to see if there were. Mm-hmm.
We've covered this a little bit, but I'll just ask the question in a different way and see if you remember how people felt about the mainstream women's rights movement. So things like the pageant protests and Ms. Magazine and consciousness-raising groups, or if those weren't even really thought about much, and like you said, it was just more of labor orientation and thinking about working women's rights.
Well, I think that they were aware of things. The thing about burning the bras at the Miss America pageant, I still wonder if that part of that is also mythology. that I don't think people paid. Well, of course, that was early on in the women's movement, too. People did tend to read Ms. Magazine, because the founder of Coal Employment Project was named as one of, Betty Jean Hall was named as one of the Ms. Magazine's women to watch in the 80s or something. Mm-hmm. So they, and I think Ms. also gave kind of free subscriptions sometimes. So they tended to read Ms. Magazine and found that interesting, I think, overall. What was the other part of it? Was
consciousness raising.
You know, I think that because these women were in rural areas, they probably did not participate in consciousness raising groups. My impression is that that was a phenomenon that happened in urban areas. But, you know, their conferences every year dealt with all kinds of subjects and, everything from sexual harassment. They tended to be practically oriented to be things that would help women on the job. But, you know, there would be big sessions on sexual harassment and how to protect yourself from it and what to do, what your rights were. And then things around health and safety, particularly protective clothing and equipment for women, because that was a big issue. The gloves and equipment that the companies issued were not, usually didn't fit the women. And then there were issues around job assignments. So the it'd be interesting to look at the workshop titles from each of those every year, because there was a committee of women who met every year to plan that conference. Mm-hmm. So the conference workshops really reflected what was on their minds, what they were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually had a speaker. You know, often they had speakers who were women who were nationally known. I can't remember who some of them were, but to come and be a speaker. And then sometimes it was men, you know, the head leadership from the mine workers. But I mean, we heard and got our picture taken with Gloria Steinem when she was in East Texas once, because we were working on a project down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember who other women were that came and spoke, but Addie White, maybe from who was from Clue, and who was a African American trade union. It seems like she spoke at one of the conventions, although I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. But go back and review those and see who spoke at those conferences. An interesting group of women, lawyers and different things like that.
Well, what was your sense of how coal mining communities, the not just the women in the community, but communities as a whole accepted the CEP or the organizing that women were getting involved in?
It was controversial in the beginning, and the women themselves were controversial in the beginning. The stories that a lot of them told, they really were, some of them were really under suspicion from the other coal miners' wives and things, because, you know, if you're working in an underground mine, you're underground with these men all these hours, and so there was a lot of suspicion and discrimination toward them, I think, in the very beginning. But then slowly but surely it began to wear off, I think, as more women went in to the mines. And now I don't, you know, I think in the early years, too, the union didn't know what to make of Coal Employment Project, because it was an independent organization, and it was an organization, most of the people on staff were women, and most of the people who went to the conferences were women. So, you know, because it was independent and not controlled by the union, I think there was some maybe some mistrust occasionally, but also I think some respect. Mm-hmm. Because the women tended to take on some issues sometimes that the union wouldn't take on. Like, remember one year, this would have been in the 80s sometime, because I was there from 83 or late 82 until 87. We did a workshop at one of the conferences on the environment and on acid rain. And the union at that time took the position that acid rain didn't exist, that there needed to be more study of it, and it needed to be studied more in order to prove that there really was acid rain. And the women tended to be more kind of, open your minds, this is the companies that are saying this, this is the company line, you know, if something is bad for us, it's bad for the trees, or if it's bad for the trees, it's bad for us. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be a little bit bolder on some of the environmentally linked issues to mining. And so that's sometimes caused some tension between them and the union. I think, you know, for the most part, for the community, Coal Employment Project was accepted, or maybe there wasn't any, you know, opinion. It's hard to say who, you know, you have to kind of target or pinpoint who in the community in particular.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the suspicions. I saw a lot of that when I was going through the records of women's personal testimonies and trying to make it clear that they didn't want these jobs because they were trying to steal people's husbands, and how sexuality really became a big part of it was really fascinating.
Right.
As though coal mining was a safe space for these women to send their husbands. There was no threat. You know, they knew they could trust them if they were there or something.
And besides,
like that.
I mean, that is not the most that's not the sexiest place in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a coal mine with all that water and dust and dirt.
Right.
And coal and everything. I mean, it's really kind of weird, but it's like, you know, in the very, very beginning when Coal Employment Project started and the women started going underground in the mines, and that was, I think, the first woman went underground in 73, according to the NIOSH statistics. There was the same kind of superstition about women in coal mines that there was about women on boats, that there used to be years ago, mm-hmm. that it was bad luck for a woman to be in a coal mine,
mm-hmm.
and that something bad would happen, there would be an accident or something.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's how the project got started.
Mm-hmm.
Was they were taking a tour in Campbell County, and I think a female organizer from Saucon was supposed to go on the tour, and the guy, the mine operator, said, you can't let this woman go because it's bad luck. And so Betty Jean Hall had been interning, I think, with Dan, or maybe she came the next summer, but the people associated with that, I think Neil McBride of East Tennessee Legal Services, raised the question about, if that's a superstition, then are women getting hired in the mines? And that's where the idea came from, I think, to do the project.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Did problems arise that you didn't expect, or on the other hand, did alliances develop that you wouldn't necessarily have expected?
Well, you know, I think that sometimes we get the impression that women's organizations are, you know, just rah-rah sisterhood, everything, but they have their own kinds of problems, because I think women, because of their internalized depression, sometimes play that internalized depression plays out in weird kinds of ways sometimes, and they take it out on each other. So sometimes there ended up being kind of problems that you wouldn't have anticipated because of the women, the personalities involved, or you know, just suspicion and distrust, or you know, stuff like that. I was trying to think in terms. I think that some of the alliances from, or some of the support from the men on the maternity paternity leave, mm-hmm. I was really rather surprised at how solid support it seemed to get. It got from those women. There were 17 women who we brought together for a workshop to train them to work on this, and they developed the language to be used in the clause, and then they developed a strategy for getting it passed at the convention, and in their locals they sent resolutions to the convention, to the district conventions, and then to the international convention. And overall, that effort got resounding support, and that was a bit of a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. I thought that they might have encountered some more resistance, but I think because of the way the women presented it, and because it was for both men and women, then it got a lot of support. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, and this is a bit of a broader question about your own experiences in the various organizations uh-huh. you've worked in. How do you see continuity in your own experiences as an activist who participated in several movements, sometimes emphasizing women's rights, sometimes emphasizing labor or community activism more? But is there something that for you bridged all of those things? I guess I was thinking you in particular, because you have that you worked with religious activists, you've done women's rights stuff, you've done the labor stuff, you've done uh-huh. Southern empowerment. You have a really varied uh-huh. movement history.
Well, the involvement of women is a real thread. I think wherever I've been, the importance of women having a voice and being respected, and their leadership being valued, and their ability to be elected as a leader or chosen as a leader has been a very important thread, and also that they get a chance to participate fully and not be discriminated against has been a big factor. And I really have to say that when I came back to the labor movement 5 years ago, after being away for so long, I was really kind of disappointed that a lot of things, I was not disappointed that a lot of things had changed. Some things had changed, and there were more women involved and more women on staff of organizations, but not as many women in leadership some places where they needed to be. And the same thing for people of color, that it still basically is pretty much dominated by white men. They're a bit younger. Some of them are getting older, but some of them are younger. But it still is overall pretty much a white guys' club. And I guess the theme, another theme is, yeah, I think that even runs through the religious stuff, is that the another thread is the need to, you know, stand up for whoever's lowest on the totem. Well, that's not a good term to use, lowest on the totem pole. Mm-hmm. But who is, you know, that group of people that is oppressed and needs of their voice to be heard. And I guess those are the overarching themes, and that you know, that the being grounded in some kind of faith community or some kind of basic belief about people and their ability to do things, is that people can change, and that we can make things better, and that that often it looks like that things are pretty bad, and they are pretty bad, but that if you just keep believing and working for it, that you can turn things around, and you'll make a few steps forward and sometimes a few steps back. But I think that faith, that belief, kind of keeps you going when the times get tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very profound.
Well, do you think so? Your disappointment in the labor movement, when do you think that? I mean, obviously, it's not as easy as this, but either the women's movement didn't do enough to emphasize how economics plays out in women's, especially poor women's lives and working women's lives, or that the labor movement didn't do enough to kind of reach out to its women workers and bring them in and get them involved in leadership positions.
The second one, I think the labor, I think it's going to take I mean, there are women in leadership positions, but there are not enough of them who are actually in the top leadership positions. And who knows, maybe that won't change anything. I tend to think that it will. I mean, if they're just imprints of the kind of men that are the top leaders, then maybe it won't change. But mm-hmm. but they should be more sensitive to the issues for women workers, and you know, of course, I think there is more sensitivity to families in general in the labor movement now than there was. But I think it's the second. I think that the labor movement hasn't, or that the top leadership in the labor movement, and maybe it's that the women, that as women we haven't pushed enough to support other women, and to push, you know, some of these guys out of leadership. There are more women on the executive committee or the executive council of the AFL-CIO than there were some years ago. But if you still look at how many women are heads of international unions, they're not very many. And if you look at Change to Win, the head of the Change to Win unions and stuff, they're not any women who are heads of those unions either, and they're supposed to be among the more progressive. And so some of the men leaders are decidedly better. Mm-hmm. I think Larry Cohen is. I don't know how he is on women's issues and feminist issues, but in terms of democracy, he's just really very good. And the CWA, which is the union that I belong to as a member of the guild, is a very good democratic union. So I think the men leaders have improved, and they're open to women's issues more, and there are women. But maybe it's going to take another generation of where we'll see that, you know, it'll be women who head up these organizations, and then I really hope that it will make some difference. But I think what's happened in the labor movement in the last 10 years has been really, really shaped by these male egos, and that, you know, the whole split between Change to Win and the AFL-CIO really was, I think, shaped by white male egos. And some of these guys are, all of them are probably pretty good people, but it's their stuff that's gotten in the way, I think. And, you know, at the local level, it hasn't really made very much difference at all. Mm-hmm. In none of the situations did anybody in the unions, the rank and file, get to vote. I don't think. I could mm-hmm. be wrong. I don't think anybody that was the rank and file person got to vote on whether to withdraw from the AFL-CIO or, you know, those decisions were made at the leadership levels of the executive councils or the heads of these international unions or their executive boards of their international unions. And the rank and file at the local level didn't get a say. And so they continued to work with, and all the campaign, I was on a campaign when this change happened. It was right after I got hired. Not long after I got hired, that the split came, and we had serious layoffs at the AFL-CIO. Well, on the campaign I was working on at the local level, it didn't matter. People from United Food and Commercial Workers continued to work with people from other unions, from the UAW, from the mine workers, because they had relationships that they built for years. They were friends. They were neighbors. They were people who'd worked in the labor movement together. And that's, I see that in the other campaigns that I'm on. That mm-hmm. At the local level, it didn't make that much difference. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we can develop leaders who will help rebuild the labor movement from the bottom up, mm-hmm. and really stay focused on what the needs of workers in this country are. They're going to have to come up with some new ideas, and I hope that women will be a part of that solution, of that new leadership.
Mm-hmm. So how, kind of paralleling all of that, how have your ideas about women's rights changed over time?
Well, I hope I wouldn't say that I've gotten that I've become an accommodationist, if there is such a term. I guess now that I'm older, I still get angry sometimes about things. Maybe I'm not as vocal as I used to be, and I should be, but when I still see a program that's almost all men, maybe one token woman or something, I still get upset. But I think I'm able now to kind of focus on the bigger issues, I hope, that are important. I guess one of my disappointments, this is not the question you asked, but is that the women's organizations, some of them had a short-lived history. They didn't last as long as they should have or mm-hmm. could have, and that's a disappointment.
Why do you think they didn't last?
Well, and maybe, and the other part of it is maybe they didn't need to last forever, because our hope was that then that those organizations could effect a change. For instance, it would be nice if the Coal Employment Project were still around, but a lot of us, there are not that many women working in the mines since the 80s. A lot of them got laid off and never came back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was a question of resources, I think, that they essentially folded up. They weren't able to raise money and couldn't reinvent themselves to get foundation money. So, I mean, I guess some of the original ideas were that these organizations, it's like forming a caucus, you know, you form a caucus in a bigger organization in order to push for some of the things that your identity group mm-hmm. wants or needs. I think with the hope that once you win those, then you may not have to keep the caucus alive forever, mm-hmm. but that you can then integrate back into the big organization and you will have brought about that kind of change that you wanted to see and become a part of the leadership of the bigger organization. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it was maybe not all the women's organizations needed to survive, but I'm glad, for instance, that there's still a national organization of women. I'm not a member, but I'm glad that NOW is still there. I don't know how active and effective they are, but I'm glad that there are still women's, you know, of course the League of Women Voters has been around mm-hmm. forever, you know. I'm glad that there are still women's organizations. We formed a women's group in the Democratic Party here in Loudoun County, and that has been a really interesting 15 years ago, I would have never done that. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm part of what's changed about me now and my perception of the women's movement is I'm also more willing to kind of align myself with women from more, these women are not terribly middle class, although some of them in Tellico Village, their husbands were in management of auto companies or something. Mm-hmm. They are more middle class in a way, but willing to work together with them for common goals mm-hmm. and not put off by the class differences mm-hmm. as much, I think. Still committed to the priority on working and poor women, you know, and their issues, but willing to also make alliances with women from other class backgrounds mm-hmm. to work for things that are needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I've been thinking about, and this will wrap up here, but I've been thinking about how, you know, the women's movement the part of the women's movement that was helping women to break into jobs that they didn't have before came up against this crisis because the economy was changing so rapidly at the same time. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that. I know Highlander Center addressed some of those things, but I wonder your opinion on how that situation was addressed, or if people really even understood how vastly things were going to change, and if they could have possibly prepared for that, or if it was just so huge.
Well, you know, in the beginning, I guess we thought that they were going to be, you know, that people were in, when the economic crisis of the early 80s hit, that people were going to be laid off for a few years. I don't think we anticipated that there was going to be such a shift in the whole industrial base of the country. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know how we could have. I guess we could have prepared. Boy, that's something I'd have to really think about. Because it was really good that we had those women's organizations who did that pushing to get women into those occupations and stuff, because it did break the mold. Mm-hmm. And women can go into traditionally male jobs now, and I think there's not as much discrimination. There are not that many women still in those jobs, mm-hmm. percentage-wise. But I don't know what we could have done to if we had known that this change in the industrial base was going to be so strong. I guess we would have pushed for women to go, to get more women, you know, scholarships and stuff to go to college, maybe, in order to change their economic condition. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have counted so much on those traditionally unionized, industrialized jobs to change their economic mm-hmm. base. And, I mean, now I'm working in Detroit, and, of course, all that's happening in the auto industry. Right. And, you know, there are lots of women in those auto plants and mm-hmm. stuff. And lots of them in the UAW, and what's going to happen to those, all of those families is really staggering. Mm-hmm. you know, I guess maybe we would have pushed for women to go, younger women to go into professions, but I think they are, though. I think my impression is that younger women don't, there aren't the psychological barriers to some of these things that our generation had to break into.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women becoming engineers and doctors and lots of women lawyers and stuff like that. In college, I bet they're starting to become a majority of the
people teaching
in colleges.
Majority of PhD students, somebody told me
recently. Oh, really?
I think just a
And I bet
one.
The med schools are about half and half or more now. Mm-hmm. And women as heads of universities, you know, women as heads of universities, there are more of them out there than there are heads of international unions, aren't there? Hmm. I bet, if you compared.
Yeah. I wouldn't be
They've really broken through on some ground on that.
Okay. Well, are there any questions that you thought I would ask that I didn't ask, or anything that you think you should add that you've thought about but haven't had the opportunity to say?
Well, I guess just once again, I would say that in whatever aspect of wherever you're involved, wherever women are involved, in whatever kinds of organizations, the church, the university, political parties, unions, the workplace, or whatever, is just so important for women to be able to have full participation and to be in full leadership. If they so desire, of those organizations. In some places we've got, so, yeah, I think both the church, the church, there's been some strides made too. But in all of those places, we just have to be ever vigilant about women's leadership and bringing other women along. That has to be emphasized, that's a trait, a good trait of leadership. Don't pull the ladder up behind yourself, but make it a part of your leadership to bring other women along and involve them and get them going and get them in leadership. Mm-hmm.